You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 167 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Human Spirit, Past and Present, Occult Fraternities and the Mystery of Golgotha, 12 lectures given in Berlin, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 11, given on the 23rd of May, 1916. Last time we found, to our surprise perhaps, that a great number of those who officially represent Christianity in the West have less belief in Christ Jesus, accord him less truth, than any faithful Mohammedan, any faithful adherent of the Quran. And we saw that we can better understand the Jesus of the Quran through insights we gain about the figure of Christ Jesus when we contemplate the teachings of spiritual science, which tells us that the Zarathustra soul dwelt in the body of the Solomon Jesus boy until he reached the age of 12. We know that this Zarathustra soul then passed into the body of the Nathan Jesus boy, and that in the 30th year of the life of this Jesus, the Christ spirit took possession of what had thus developed. As we saw last time, if we consider the idea of Jesus in the Quran, it inevitably concurs to some degree with the Nathan Jesus. You even find in the Quran a reference to something I drew from purely spiritual scientific sources and needed to tell you, that the Nathan Jesus child uttered words the moment he was born. And thus the view of Jesus entertained by many theologians, who profess themselves to be, in quotes, free spirits, does not even permit them to call themselves heathen, let alone Christians. In our midst, there are many who proclaim teachings whose view of Jesus is at a lower level than that of Mohammedans. Last time I wanted to highlight this surprising fact. For many, it might perhaps show that the mission of our Western culture, insofar as it seeks the spirit, must be to increasingly contemplate the deeper nature of the mystery of Golgotha. If we combine all our knowledge and insights from the diverse worlds and apply this in the most assiduous way, we can then begin to glimpse something of what the mystery of Golgotha has meant for evolution on earth, and what the nature of this event really was. We have in the past spoken of how little headway we make in spiritual science if we think schematically, and how necessary it is to illumine these things in ever more detail from the most varied perspectives. This can tell you how beneficial it also is to look more closely from certain angles at what meets us when we reflect on Christ Jesus, firstly in terms of the line of Solomon, and secondly, in the indwelling of the Zarathustra soul in a body descended from that line, and then also to consider things that can illumine the figure of the Nathan Jesus and so forth. Today, therefore, I would like to start by speaking of Solomon himself and matters connected with him. If we only consider what is contained in the teachings of ancient Judaism, in its concepts and ideas, I mean what one finds in the Talmud or other scriptures apart from the Old Testament, which is different in this respect, we will gain inadequate ideas of the whole thought world of Judaism. In particular, we gain an inadequate sense of ideas that relate to a figure such as that of Solomon. The concepts and thoughts contained in Judaic teachings are referred to as halacha, as opposed to haggadah, which means its legends, pictures, and tales. Readers aside, halacha is probably halacha. It's H-A-L-A-C-H-A. I'm going to pronounce that halacha. End of readers aside. In reality, such tales and legends, such pictures, can be traced back to visions in the world of spirit, to what was perceived or learned from the world of spirit through clairvoyant vision. These legends and tales of the Haggadah are rooted in imaginative vision. Today, I want to take a short passage from this Haggadah as the point of departure for further reflections. This passage describes an important moment in the life of King Solomon and runs as follows, quote, Rabbi Yohanan says, subquote, the feet of man are a pledge that they will bring him to the place where he is required. Close subquote. The tale is told of those two Moors who belonged to the circle surrounding Solomon, Elichoref, Akia, the sons of Shisha, who were scribes of Solomon. One day Solomon saw the angel of death who was downcast, and he spoke to him, saying, subquote, why are you so downcast? Close subquote. At this, the angel of death replied, subquote, because the two Moors here are required by me. Close subquote. At this, Solomon gave his two Moors to the Seirim. Close quote, Steiner again. Seirim, readers aside, spelled S-E-Y-R-I-M. I do apologize for some of these pronunciations. End of aside. Seirim are demons which in imaginative vision appear in the form of goats and can fly through the air. Continue quote. At this, Solomon gave his two Moors to the Seirim and sent them to the city of Luz. When they arrived there, the two Moors, that is, they died. The next day, Solomon once more saw the angel of death. He was laughing now, and Solomon said to him, subquote, why are you laughing? Close subquote. And the angel of death replied, subquote, you sent them precisely to the place where they were required by me. Close subquote. Immediately, Solomon lifted his voice and spoke, subquote, the feet of man are a pledge that they will bring him to the place where he is required to be. Close subquote, close quote. Steiner again. In other words, Solomon had an experience of the angel of death which affirmed for him what Rabbi Yohanan stated as a general truth. Quote, the feet of man are a pledge that they will bring him to the place where he is required to be. Close quote. Now, you will admit, my dear friends, that much remains obscure in this tale from the Haggadah, and many questions about it remain. First, we hear that the feet of a human being are a pledge that he will be given up to the location where he is required to be. Why does the tale mention the feet especially? You see, in old pictorial legends of this kind, nothing is arbitrary, but all has its deeper significance. So that is the first question we can ask. Another must be this. Why was the angel of death sad when he appeared before Solomon to tell him he must fetch away his scribes? There is really no explanation in the immediate context of the story to explain this. It would, of course, be trivial to think that the angel of death was sad because he had to fetch the two. That is his task, after all. And it would be incomprehensible to think that he was sad about it. Solomon asks him, why are you so downcast? But what is the meaning of this question? The angel of death replies that it is because the two Moors, the scribes of King Solomon, are required by him, and he must fetch them. Yet Solomon gives them over to demons, who bear them away to the city of Luz. Well, the city of Luz is something easier to explain. It was a place that had, strangely, ordained that no one was permitted to die there. Those close to death were therefore carried outside the city boundaries. It was the only city that had this custom in those days. One might think that it is simply this fact that is being described, but no, it is just a part of the story. Solomon hears from the angel of death that his two scribes must die, and it is suggested that he sends them to the city of Luz, because he thinks the angel of death cannot fetch them from there. This tale from the Haggadah appears in many places in Hebrew tradition. Other such passages tell us that they fell from their mounts just outside the gates of the city, and so never arrived there, and the angel of death was still able to fetch them. Then, next day, the angel stands, laughing, before Solomon, and it would be very easy, though trivial, to say that he is pleased he succeeded in fetching them to death, and is laughing for that reason. Solomon now recognizes the truth that Rabbi Yohanan seeks to impart, that the feet of man really are a pledge that he will be brought to the place where he is required to be. Usually there is nothing at all arbitrary in such tales. It is even important that the two scribes, the two Moors, are sons of Shisha, who was himself the scribe of David. There is a suggestion that these two scribes of King Solomon were very special. We must consider all this if we wish to grasp the whole gravity of questions that can surface here, in a key moment of recognition in the life of King Solomon. Now let us remind ourselves, too, that King Solomon was called wise, not only because he was clever in the modern sense, but because he had real insights into the world of spirit, and this world was open before him. Solomon was to learn the truth recounted also by Rabbi Yohanan, related to the human feet. You see, if we consider the human being and compare him with the animals, we find a key distinction in our upright spine, in the fact that we stand vertically upon the earth, while the animal is horizontal to it. I do hope no one will object that kangaroos or such like stand vertically, for naturally these are exceptions, and can be explained if we go into these things in detail, which is not what I intend to do at present. The fact remains that the chief distinguishing mark of the human being, as regards outward shape, is that he stands upright while the animal's spine lies horizontally. If we extend the line of the animal's spine, this line will not in fact be entirely straight, but curved a little. Overlooking the S-shaped curvature, the arc of this line passes slightly downward. If we extend this average curve of the animal's spine, we will find that it can give us a circle that encompasses the earth, really a girdle round the earth. In other words, if we draw a circle parallel to the earth's curve, it will pass through the spine of animals. If we were to do the same thing for the human being, this circle would naturally not encircle the earth, but if you picture it very clearly, you would find that it has a center. In the case of the animal, the center would be the center of the earth, whereas in our case, it would be the center of the moon. Why? Because, back on Old Moon, the human being passed through the evolutionary stage which animals today are passing through in relation to the earth, and this remained with him as a legacy from that period. He is connected with the vestiges of Old Moon, in the same way as the animal is connected with the earth. Thus, the human being is connected with the vestiges of Old Moon, in the same way as the animal is connected with the earth. The human being, therefore, has detached himself from his planet, and is not as bound up with it as the animal. As far as his outward physical being is concerned, he has sundered himself from his planet, inasmuch as one aspect of his being has detached itself from this planet. Instead of the circle I spoke of, encircling the earth, it enters the earth, and this gives us our standing relationship to the earth, the position of our feet relative to it. This means that we are connected to the earth by virtue of a power that is expressed in the relationship of our feet to the ground. Our whole passage from moon to earth evolution is related to the fact that our hands are sundered from the earth while our feet still connect with it. If we understand the human form as it has developed in the transition from moon to earth evolution, we have to recognize that we belong to the earth insofar as the earth was able to draw one part of us down toward the feet, pulling us toward itself in the whole shape of the feet. What gives the earth a pledge that the human being comes to earth? The mystery of his foot position gives it. The word we find in Hebrew in this passage, quote, "the feet are a pledge," close quote, is exactly the same that is used, for instance, in financial affairs, when a pledge of some kind is given for capital. The phrase means that the feet are held back from human evolution as a pledge for the fact that in one aspect of our being we stay connected with the earth. Thus the phrase does not mean that the feet themselves carry a person to the place of his death. The whole secret of the human form lies in this phrase, and was recognized by Solomon through his capacity to see into the world of spirit. What I have now characterized in words was therefore something revealed to Solomon when he saw the vision of the angel of death. In this example, we see in turn that human beings possessed a wisdom, which on one occasion recently we have called primordial wisdom, which was lost in order to give human beings the opportunity to achieve this wisdom once again in freedom, out of their own resources, during Earth evolution. The next enigma in this tale can be the fact that the angel of death is first sad and then laughs. Laughing and weeping are not considered by most people as a question of knowledge worthy of consideration, and when they are, it can sometimes be very disconcerting to see what is said about them today, in an era when, as we heard, even marriage advertisements are thought fit for serious psychological investigation. And yet there are opportunities near at hand to consider the nature of laughing and weeping, for the population at large does have popular wisdom on the subject. If you go to the country, you will find a widespread view that if someone is walking along the road and starts laughing, all is not right with him. This points to a deeper insight, a sense that people do not laugh when alone, if they have all their wits about them, that laughter is something you do in others' company. Of course, there are always exceptions, but by and large it is true. And so, my dear friends, laughter is something we really only do in company. This is not so much the case with weeping. Indeed, we may well seek out solitude if we wish to cry fully and properly. The authenticity of those who like to weep in company may be in some doubt. A farmer does not reflect long and hard if he sees someone laughing alone, but he thinks instinctively that there is something wrong with the person in question. Why is this? To understand phenomena of human life, such as laughing and weeping, my dear friends, we really do need to draw on spiritual science. You see, what lives generally in people's awareness does not even hold entirely true in relation to material existence. I have often spoken of how people generally believe a person contains no more than what lives within his skin. This is the general view, but one that is actually itself only skin deep. Think for a minute what is inside this skin of a person. It includes air, but while it is inside one moment, the next, it is outside again. In other words, it simply is not possible to completely sunder what is inside our skin from all that our whole human existence is embedded in. The Earth's atmosphere basically belongs intrinsically and absolutely to our whole nature, entering and leaving us continually. And therefore, it will scarcely be a surprise if we extend this idea of the physical human being and his relationship to the wider atmosphere to the whole of our human nature. When we wake up in the morning, we take into ourselves something that is outside during the night. In every moment, we take into ourselves the material air that is outside us, then it is in us. When we wake up, similarly, we take into us what is outside us during the night. When we fall asleep, we breathe out our capital I and astral body, in a sense. The physical relationship which we have with the atmosphere is one we can also imagine having with the world of spirit, which corresponds and belongs to the earth. The difference is only that the air we now have in us and later will have exhaled is immediately dispersed in the outer world, whereas the I and astral body we breathe out, as it were, when we fall asleep, retain their form and return to us as they were breathed out. But just as we are connected with the atmosphere around us, through the air we contain within us, and keep breathing in and out, so there is also a tide of life that ebbs and flows between us and the other world, the world of spirit. We should not think that our I and astral body simply slip inside us and then stay there. They are related to the wider world of spirit, just as the oxygen we have within us is connected with the whole surrounding atmosphere. Through our I and our astral body, therefore, we are continually in reciprocal connection with the spiritual world. Let us assume for a moment that something strikes us as funny. What is the reality of this? It is very similar, in fact, to the physical condition that would arise if, instead of breathing in a normal quantity of air, we left a little outside us and dispersed it through our surroundings. When something strikes us comically, we extend our eye and astral body outward from us, pouring this eye and astral body into what we find comical. So when you laugh about something, you are really spreading your eye and astral body over it. This is a spiritual process, which does not involve such a repulse as when this astral body, in a different feeling, also pours into our surroundings, taking with it something from the physical body. I mean, when we stick out our tongue, as do badly behaved children. When we laugh, our tongue stays inside our mouth, but the astral body is in a similar condition in that it is drawn out sufficiently to envelop in a mist whatever makes a comical impression on it. Laughing is based on an expansion and spreading out of the astral body. And this even affects the ether body too. That is what happens when we laugh. In weeping, we find precisely the opposite process. The astral body compresses itself with the etheric body, compressing also the physical body in this contraction and expressing tears. This is much easier to understand. But you can see that laughing and crying, and naturally also being sad, which belongs to the latter, for sadness is the same process without the actual tears, that laughter and rejoicing and sadness are due to expansion on the one hand and on the other compression, contraction of the human being's invisible nature, and are due therefore also to the action and potency of this invisible nature. And so, now, you can also understand what Solomon saw. Naturally, he did not see the angel of death as a physical body, but as a spiritual being. He saw how the angel of death expanded and spread out on the second day, whereas it had contracted on the first. Here you have something that can show how spiritual beings act, how they accomplish their actions. In our case, laughter and weeping, happiness and sadness, are in a sense an accompaniment and correlate to life. by means of which we merely express our inner state, showing its mood and condition. Mostly our laughter and weeping accomplishes little for other people. We do not accomplish anything much through them. But the moment we approach certain spiritual beings, who must work far more than us through their own self and condition, expansion and contraction is the very meaning of what they accomplish. And when the angel of death arrived to fetch the two scribes, he needed to hold his powers together, to compress, condense himself, to gather his powers through this inward concentration in order to begin his work. This is expressed as sadness, which is just a way of suggesting that he compressed himself. The next day, having accomplished his work, there was a corresponding elasticity and expansion. In other words, the sadness and cheerfulness of the angel of death convey a reality of spiritual life to us. Only someone intent on thinking in trivial terms will take offense at such efforts to look beyond mundane explanations of this sadness and happiness of the angel of death, and instead see them as rooted in deeper spiritual realities. When Rabbi Yohanan discoursed, people still retained a certain feeling of the inherent nature of worlds of spirit. And in the seriousness with which this tale is recounted, we can see that Rabbi Yohanan was drawing on it as a way of enlightening people about the nature of spiritual worlds. In the late Middle Ages, however, when the fifth post-Atlantean epoch was approaching, as we described, Jewish exegesists of the Haggadah began to include people whom representatives of our enlightened times would welcome with open arms. For example, there was a Jewish exegesist, regarded as a great scholar in this progressive time, though not in the older times, when people still believed in the realm of spirits. This man said that we should relinquish old superstitious explanations of the tale and relate it all to the city of Luz. It is known that Solomon, in his day, sought locations for settlements that had good air and a good climate, places suitable for summer residence. Modern liberal scholars would certainly greet this Jewish exegesist as one of their own. If we know that the city of Luz had such a climate, and that it was founded by Solomon for this reason, then we easily discover the supposed rationale for the tale. We need only imagine that the two scribes were, well, not of a nervous disposition, since this complaint would have been unheard of then, but something of this kind, were no longer fully healthy, and that Solomon, in his wisdom, which was naturally, in the view of a modern person, a much greater wisdom than vision of the world of spirit, had recognized this. The two scribes are therefore sent to Luz to enjoy the fresh air of its summer climate, but these two died there, notwithstanding the fine climate. And this was viewed in those times as a kind of punishment or judgment. Well, in the Middle Ages, this was still a reasonable idea, and this explanation was one that arose fairly early, as the fifth post-Atlantean epoch was approaching. But why is the city of Luz mentioned in the legend? And what is the meaning of the whole event involving Solomon? Well, first we must remind ourselves, always, that Solomon is someone connected with the world of spirit. I said it was significant that his two scribes were the sons of Shisha, who had been King David's scribe. Thus they are figures of some status and importance. In those days, to be a scribe meant something different from today. For example, in Egypt, scribes, as I have mentioned previously, were required to reproduce the hieroglyphic script with great inner devotion. If someone wrote a sign wrongly, they would be condemned to death, since the script was a sacred matter. And the scribes of King Solomon, too, were people in communication with the spiritual world. They were connected with it, and, we can say, were part of the community of those who shared with Solomon his knowledge of worlds of spirit. The city of Luz occurs in the tale only to indicate that these scribes possessed a quality of connection with the spiritual world that endowed them with a sense of immortality already in their earthly life. It is a way of telling us that neither these scribes nor Solomon himself passed their earthly sojourn without knowing of their soul spiritual core, which passes through the portal of death. This was not just a theoretical knowledge, but to some degree they were initiated into these secrets. For this reason, the angel of death needed to connect in a certain way with King Solomon. That is, since the two scribes were aware of their immortality, and since Solomon himself, especially, was aware of this, the angel of death had to approach what he must now undertake in a way that consciously involved Solomon in their death. The tale does not convey an effort on the part of Solomon to protect his scribes from death by sending them to Luz. Instead, it seeks to show that death here occurred in full awareness, that full account was taken of it. This is the main emphasis, that Solomon was aware that his scribes would die. And saying that he sent them to the city of Luz is only a way of suggesting that Solomon saw the Ahrimanic power, which is embodied in the angel of death, approaching in the form of its agencies, the goat demons. Thus the tale seeks to give us a vivid sense of the conscious unfolding of the process it describes. A death occurs which the wise initiate consciously observes. That is what Rabbi Yohanan wished to suggest. And the whole process was transformed into a knowledge possessed by Solomon, so that he now knew how the human being is connected with the earth and the world of spirit. The tale recounts the emergence of knowledge of the supersensible in King Solomon. We only understand the story as it should be understood if we take it as a retrospective account of a process clairvoyantly witnessed by King Solomon. Rabbi Yohanan stated that human beings are bound to the earth through the form of their physical body. The way in which the form of the feet and their position relative to the earth connects them to the earth expresses a one-sided relationship, insofar as only the feet are a pledge for the fact that humankind belongs to the earth. But the human being's upright stance is a pledge for the fact that the essential core of his being is given up to the world of spirit. In order for Solomon to be able to believe this, he was granted conscious vision of the death of comrades precious to him. You see, therefore, that we only grasp these things with concepts and ideas which are themselves drawn from the world of spirit. And many old legends, as they are called, can only be understood by approaching them with spiritual scientific ideas. But there is great significance in the recounting of this precise fact about King Solomon, for it tells us that Solomon's wisdom consisted of the capacity to look into the spiritual world, in which the secret of death is first unveiled. And when we learn of the ancient mysteries, that the first stage of initiation involves a person experiencing his approach to the portal of death, then what we discover in this legend is really nothing other than that Solomon was one such initiate and had come to this threshold. In the line of generations descended from King Solomon, we have in a sense the physical preparation for this clairvoyance which approaches the threshold of death. The body of Jesus is thus descended from the Solomon line of the house of David, and the soul is that of Zarathustra. And now let us be very clear what the importance is of the Zarathustra soul, why the soul of Zarathustra indwells a body that is descended from a figure who possessed clairvoyance. I have often spoken of what came from the soul of Zarathustra. Today, let us only consider the aspect that primarily later led to the teachings of Zarathustra and then chiefly passed on into the teachings of Mani and Manichaeism. One of the profoundest questions which the enigma of the human being poses for us is certainly the relationship between the good, sunny qualities in human life and the evil, shadowy sides of our nature. We know how much of this we can understand when we gain insight into the influence of Lucifer and Ahriman. But this doctrine of Lucifer and Ahriman, in a sense, leads us back to Zarathustra, to his two spiritual potencies as distinct from the good progressive deities. In the teachings of Zarathustra, we already find the figures of Lucifer and Ahriman as a reality of the world of spirit. But there was something that could not enter this teaching of Zarathustra, my dear friends, because of a certain insight it had into the workings of Lucifer and Ahriman. Something could not form part of these teachings, and in subsequent ages this became an insuperable obstacle for humankind. If one no longer understands the interplay between Lucifer and Ahriman in the world in the right way, one no longer fully understands the world either. Good remains an enigma, as does evil. From this perspective, let us now look at a later doctrine which is distinguished by the fact that its proponents no longer knew how to encompass the ancient teachings of Zarathustra. This is the doctrine of predestination, and all that is connected with this in Mohammedanism. On the one hand, this teaching of predestination clearly states that everything which happens is determined in advance. Everything has been, as it were, pre-described in the Ur-text of the most ancient primordial times. I cannot step out of my door without this having been determined in advance. The time of my death is fixed in advance. Everything is strictly predetermined. For a strict Mohammedan, nothing happens in life that has not been written down previously in the Book of God. But at the same time, whenever a Mohammedan speaks of what might be about to happen, what he hopes will happen, he says, as we might say in Europe, quote, if God wills it, close quote, he will not forget to use this phrase in relation to matters that seem important to him, if God wills it. If you ask a Western person or a Mohammedan himself how these two things can be reconciled, that everything is predetermined and inscribed in advance, and so it can make no sense to say if God wills, since if predetermination is true, then there is nothing left to will. They will both say that this is an insoluble contradiction. It is indeed. If you read all of Western philosophy, Spinoza, Descartes, Kant, Fichte, Schelling, Hegel, and so on, you will be able to trace in their works the continuing repercussions of this insoluble contradiction, which surfaces in especially blatant form in the doctrine of kismet, of predestination in Mohammedanism. Here, therefore, we have a teaching which in this respect is different from that of Zarathustra. The teaching of Zarathustra would not see a contradiction here, because it encompasses Lucifer and Ahriman. And now, you may recall our reflections here, in which we considered how these things are reconciled. From this we can acknowledge a primordial teaching in humanity's evolution that did not give rise to any such contradiction. Yet this transformed into another that cannot get round the contradiction except by ignoring it unthinkingly. This contradiction, my dear friends, is merely similar to many others, though it is one which most closely affects life. It resembles a great many other contradictions that we repeatedly encounter. Anyone who refuses to acknowledge that life is full of contradictions is completely ignoring one side of reality. Life is full of contradictions if we consider it from the standpoint of human reason. And this indeed is what we must do, draw on human reason. In other words, it was necessary for a time to dawn when the human being found himself enmeshed in contradictions. The Zarathustra era was to be succeeded by a time when human beings learn through contradictions, are by this means spurred on to discover their true inner life. Among the many things that earthly evolution should impart to humankind, the many trials we pass through, is this awareness of living in contradictions. Now, let us reflect that the fourth post-Atlantean epoch was a kind of midway point of earthly evolution. In this fourth epoch, what the earth should primarily impart to us had not yet emerged, and would do so only in the middle of the fifth epoch. And the nature of the contradiction relates to this. Contradictoriness is inherent in the earth element. Why was this not already present in Zarathustra's teaching? Because he still enjoyed the legacies of ancient times. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, human beings were already fully immersed in mundane reality, in earthly things. If people were to gain nothing for their inner powers of reason and understanding, then what can be derived from the earth, they would not be able to get beyond the contradictions either. But then the remainder of earthly evolution would pass with the human being inwardly devouring himself in these contradictions, which would destroy his soul. You see, the spiritual element that can only develop through our earthly sojourn inevitably involves contradictions. What had to happen for the human being to be led forth again beyond contradictions? Something that belongs to the earth but has not passed through humanity's earthly evolution had to enter it. Something had to enter that had remained behind in ancient Lemurian times when the human being descended. And this was the being of the Nathan Jesus. The Nathan Jesus stands close to humankind because, we can say, he remained latent and did not engage in earthly evolution. And yet he is free of human contradictions because of this very fact. And only entered the earthly realm when humankind had brought its contradictoriness to a culminating point of evolution in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch. At this moment, he appears as a remedy to the contradiction that inevitably evolves in human nature as we pass through our earthly sojourn. Truly, for their spiritual evolution, human beings must have access to the old legacy from Zarathustrian culture. But in addition to this, they must acquire the contradictory nature they experience on earth. This is why the Zarathustra Jesus, the Solomon Jesus, had to be complemented by the Nathan Jesus. And those like the Mohammedans, whose religious confession is otherwise pervaded by this terrible contradiction between predestination and, in quotes, if God wills, also at the same time gained the revelation and blessing of the Nathan Jesus. Where, eventually, they find sufficient developmental capacity to comprehend this, they will acknowledge that recognition of the nature of the one whom the Quran reveals to them can enable them to discover how predestination and, if God wills, are reconciled. In our current stage of evolution, the Mohammedan has not yet achieved this. But in a sense, he bears these developmental seeds within him, and they are present, albeit only germinally. Christians should have got further and should comprehend what they possess in the being who passed through the mystery of Golgotha and how the powers of earthly evolution really have united in him, they should understand that humanity's primordial legacy has come to them through the nature of Zarathustra, while the direct gift of human essence entered in the Nathan Jesus. This is as far as we will go in these reflections for now. But from this you can once more discern how everything is united and reconciled. You can see how things that coexist side by side in life do so for good reason. In the Quran we find predestination standing side by side with "if God wills it." But at the same time, a remedy is there, the Nathan Jesus. You see, my dear friends, how we approach the real, intrinsic nature of human life and attempt to broach this in its loftiest forms by drawing on spiritual, scientific concepts. We live in a time when the old forms of knowledge are fading. There are only a few now who still retain this old mode of knowledge, the instinctive knowledge that is a legacy from clairvoyant times. These few are mocked and ridiculed, and the other form of knowledge, just beginning to emerge, a knowledge of the rational mind, is regarded by those who trumpet its glories as being in full bloom. Those who see things in their proper light, however, know that such knowledge is just beginning and is still very inadequate. Realities outstrip this knowledge. In ancient times, when knowledge was endowed by the gods, things were different. It was adapted to and in tune with reality. People now have no inkling that realities speed ahead of them, while their knowledge hems them in like a dress that is far too small and tight. As realities emerge, therefore, human beings are as yet unable to use them sufficiently and learn from them what they need to. In recent years, a very rigorous scholar drew on advanced economic ideas to demonstrate that no war in the modern era can last longer than 3 to 4 months at the most. He used, quote, "strict scientific methods," close quote, to prove this. What can rational people learn from this, now that the war has already lasted 2 years? They could see that this theory is inadequate to explain the facts. But people do not draw such conclusions so readily. They hold back from doing what they should, questioning why someone with all the tools of modern economic theory can prove that a war cannot last longer than 3 or 4 months, and yet his theories are clearly not adequate, cannot encompass reality. This is an unpleasant discovery. The man in question has been well schooled in modern disciplines. To be really consistent in one's thinking, one would ultimately have to acknowledge that all schools of economics, university economics departments, should be abolished. Since this really cannot be done, it has to be accepted that economics must continue in modern life in the form it has. Continuing as it is, it will certainly offer many more such "strict and rigorous proofs," in quotes, with dire results. And yet if one drew further-reaching consequences, examining whether perhaps other theories would prove equally inadequate to circumstances or not, who knows what might follow from this. And this cannot be countenanced, of course, and so all these things continue to be regarded as true. You see, my dear friends, some courage is required to think things through to the end, and people do not always have this courage. And yet this is what is needed to some degree. It may well be that even then things won't all suddenly change. Think of all the pensions that would have to be paid to the professors without jobs if these economics departments were abolished. But even if things can't change radically from one day to the next, they could slowly find better channels if a group of people at least had the courage to think properly, think correctly, and allow what is right in this context to filter through wherever it can. This would be important. In such things, one always starts with oneself and tries to think correctly to the degree this is possible. You see, life progresses not by itself, but through human endeavor. And though many take comfort from the thought that things won't change all of a sudden, since, quote, nature takes no sudden leaps, close quote, the world doesn't suddenly take a step forward. This is not true. The world constantly takes sudden leaps. What would happen, do you think, if a green leaf were to keep saying, quote, I am forbidden from taking sudden leaps, close quote? The leaf would become a very slightly different green leaf, but it would never become a rose, as it does, for the rose emerges from a sudden leap. Nature takes leaps everywhere, and the same is true in human life. Things do not develop comfortably without a leap into the unknown, but everywhere new developments emerge, new sudden leaps, and we must remember this. We can already achieve a good deal by judging things correctly, untinged by predilections or desires about how we wish them to be. You see, thoughts are already living powers. But in our time, people do not manage to form healthy, forthright, positive judgments about things. Instead, they accept things as they are without real inner participation, without inner involvement and feeling. For instance, would it not be right and natural for someone who speaks about literary matters, about the literature of a nation, to understand a little of what he is talking about? But this is not universally the case. Recently, we have been very thoroughly instructed in the meaning of German literature by a man who knows nothing about it. He is not even a professor of literature, but the president of a republic, and has not had an opportunity to learn a subject which he felt called upon to lecture about to a whole nation. A political advocate lectures us on literature. A poet instructs us in politics. Both these things have occurred recently, one after another. We must reflect on such phenomena and form our thoughts accordingly. It seems to me that we are far too indifferent and unconcerned nowadays, and theosophy is not there to persuade us to be even more indifferent in a way that is often regarded as calm, or, using the word quite wrongly, composed. Composure is something one has to strive for and should by no means make us indifferent to everything. Modern life is asking us to have some fire and energy in our recognition of what is good, and in our abomination of what ought not and must not be. This is necessary if evolution is really to progress in the way that the benevolent spirits of humanity desire. We will speak further of this next time. The end of Lecture 11.